The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 7. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. How's everyone doing tonight? If you guys have a question, make sure that you start with highlighting question or putting it in capital letters so I can see it. If you guys want to book an hour, if you got some specific questions regarding real estate or the Colombian market or entrepreneurship, anything like that that we talk about on this channel, go ahead and email Sebastian at admin@georgegammon.com. And he can set up an hour-long consultation where I really take a deep dive into your specific situation. Let's dive right into the questions. Well, James says, a massive gold discovery occurred in the world, which doubled the world supply. Would our gold we own lose 50% of value? Yeah, most likely, James, unless something else happened at the same time, you're just doubling the supply. So it's just like if you double the supply of currency, you know, it's just the price of goods and services will probably double if it gets into the economy and spinning around at the same rate with the velocity. Mr. Fat Face says, will there be a repo liquidity crunch on December 31st due to tax payment and fiscal year rollovers? Well, we did a video on that last Friday. And if I had to place a bet on it, I would say probably not going to have a catastrophic type event. If it does spike, I think there's enough liquidity there. And the reason I'm saying that is because if you look at if it's oversubscribed, each overnight repo, you can see if it's undersubscribed or oversubscribed. And lately, they've actually been undersubscribed, meaning that the Fed is committing to putting more liquidity than the market is demanding. So I think that they could be all right. Although Zoltan said that don't count it out yet, I can't remember his exact quote from an article that I saw recently when a reporter brought that up to him, that it's been undersubscribed. Therefore, how does he feel going into the year turned? And he still is apprehensive, although he admits that the liquidity issue is a lot better now than it was when he came out with that report on December 9th. Okay, Ben asks, what would push you to expatriate from the United States? Well, first and foremost, Ben, from a tax standpoint, if it gets too crazy, I've done videos on Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, and the people who are pro a wealth tax, I don't think that they really have studied the natural course of taxes in our U.S. history. And what I mean by that is whenever we come out with a new tax, like the income tax back in 1913, ironically enough, when the Fed was set up, it's always just a tax for the rich people. It always starts off with a tax just for the rich. Don't worry about it. This isn't going to affect the normal people. And sure enough, within a year or 5 years, it's affecting the normal people. So in that video that I did, I showed how I think that the wealth tax could start at 50 million now, but within 5 years, it'll go down to 500,000, in which case it would affect a lot of people, including me. So if that came to pass, I would definitely think about it. And most people don't realize, and I want to be clear, I'm not suggesting anyone do that. It is not for everyone. But I think that most people don't understand or think that it's a lot scarier than it really is. And the reason I say that is because you can get an investment visa for the United States. People don't realize that. They think that we're just this island of success and we would never sell citizenship or entry into the United States. And that's just not true. You can, I think it's maybe a $500,000 investment or $1 million investment, and it can be real estate in the United States, and you get a visa. So if you're one of those people that had dual citizenship and you just didn't like the direction of the United States for whatever reason, but you still wanted to go back, I mean, that's a way to do it right there. And again, I'm not suggesting anyone do that, But there are a lot of options out there. But that would be the first thing that would get me to really rethink if this is something I want to be a part of long term, would be those taxes. And if they start, or if they start confiscating property, such as gold, that, in fact, that would really, if they pull that one out, I probably won't stick around too long. Okay, Baxter, the question is thoughts on how the USMCA passing and a potential China deal would impact the U.S. economy. Some say China's never going to agree to a deal. And with the USMCA, Baxter, I'm assuming that you're referring to the trade deal with Mexico that's in the works. Hopefully I've got that right. Let's start there, because I just listened to a Schiff podcast the other day where he addressed some points on this that I thought were extremely valid. And the main one is that a lot of Mexico's pushback is that we are requiring them to have the same type of labor laws that we have in the United States, which is to say that we want them to up a minimum wage. We want a lot of the things that, quite frankly, make us less competitive from a manufacturing standpoint. We want them to apply those same type of laws in their country, which would be disastrous. You can't, you're comparing apples to oranges there, and you're taking away pretty much their only competitive advantage as a country. But setting that aside, basically what we're trying to do is bully them into being less competitive so the United States can be more competitive without having to increase our rates of productivity. And I think that if I was Mexico, I'd be telling the U.S. to pound sand. I'd say, forget it. This is terrible. The only thing that the U.S. is trying to angle for is to make us less competitive, and I just wouldn't go for it. So I'd be surprised if that goes through. Now, as far as the China deal, I don't know that it would impact the U.S. economy that much. It all depends on the deal. And right now, to me, and I haven't studied this thoroughly, but to me, it just looks like what China has agreed to, and let's call it a phase one, is really just kind of what they are already doing, which is buying food from the United States. So maybe it has some impact on the fringes. I think long term, if it stays in place, then it will have greater and greater impact. But just over the short term, I don't think it's doing much. And I think the U.S. consumer is absorbing the majority of the costs for that trade deal. And let's see, some say China's never going to agree to a deal. Yeah, it's all about who has the most leverage. And that swings back and forth. But right now, although China's in a pretty bad spot as well, yeah, it's interesting because the two countries need each other a lot. And I think that's something that most people forget. So I would say there's probably going to be a deal for that reason, but I don't think it's going to be anything to jump up and down about. I don't think it'll change much from how it's been in the past. All right, Kevin, thanks for the super chat. Kevin asks, other than gold and silver, do you see any currency as a safe haven currency? Your channel is great. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate the kind words. To be clear, I don't see gold and silver as currency. I see it as actual money. So what's the difference? Currency to me is a way to exchange your excess productivity or your productivity for another person or a group of people's excess productivity. Money or gold and silver is a way to store your excess productivity. And so, but I get your question. You're basically asking if I see any currencies as safe haven. No. I mean, that's the short answer. But I do suggest diversifying your currency risk. So as most of you guys know, my kind of three pillars of investing is buy stuff when it's cheap, make sure it's paying you to own it, diversify your currency risk and your political risk. So let's say that you thought the Singapore dollar was a quote-unquote safe haven for whatever reason. You came to that conclusion. I really wouldn't suggest buying Singapore dollars or Singapore bonds I mean, just me being me, I would suggest buying a Singaporean real estate. So like a condo that you could rent out. So you're actually getting paid. You've got a hard asset there. And the reason I say that, or at least a share of a company that was a good dividend paying company. And the reason I say that is because if you buy the Singaporean dollar, and I'm just using that as an example, you still have, what if it doesn't work out? What if it loses value? What if you bet the wrong way? If you've got a hard asset or even a share of a company, it's got a lot better chance of going up with inflation. So you've kind of got a hedge against you being wrong, but yet you've still got an asset that's rather liquid, which is also a play on that currency, because that asset is denominated in the currency that you think is, let's just call it strong. That's probably not the right word, but stronger than the US dollar. Okay, Geo Rob asks, recently cashed out of large annuity for fear of future collapse. Okay, beside precious metals, crypto, foreign accounts, any other suggestions? Okay, so I mean, I don't know what you're working with, Rob. I like what you mentioned, but let me be clear. You're mentioning a lot of different things there, and I wouldn't lump all of those into the same category. So as an example, precious metals, to me, that's an insurance play. Crypto, to me, that's a speculation. Those are two completely separate reasons for owning something. And in my opinion, you should definitely differentiate between the two. Foreign accounts, again, a different reason for owning that. That's you're diversifying your political risk there, or maybe some of your currency risk. So what you don't have in there is you don't have anything that I would consider an investment. So to me, an investment would mean that it has to pay you to own it, just like an annuity. So that would be really good cash flowing real estate in a linear market or overseas, or stocks that you can get cheap that pay you a good stream of cash flow. Obviously, you're probably not going to find any of those in the United States, but if you do some digging, you can find them in other places around the world. But it's going to take a lot of homework. These to make good investments in this type of environment where we're literally in an everything bubble, you can't just, it's not like the old days where you just have a 60-40 split of equities and bonds and you just set it and forget it. Because if the equities go down, the bonds go up and vice versa, it just doesn't work that way anymore. So, and especially with something like your money, I find it very curious that most people will research, let's say they're buying a new car. And the first thing you do when you buy a new car is you go online and you do your research. People will research that for a month, just hours and hours and hours, and selecting the right car for their needs and the color and the features that it has. Or if you're a real car guy like me, you know, you're looking at the horsepower and the torque and all those cool things. But if we look at an investment, you just go down to your local financial advisor and you meet with them for 10 minutes and be like, okay, yeah, that's what I want to do. It's like, what are you doing? You allocate hours and hours and hours to buying a car, but you spend 15 minutes thinking about how you want to invest your net worth. It needs to be the opposite. So that's probably the suggestion I'd give you, is make sure you're doing your homework and make sure that you've got something in the mix there that's an actual investment, or what I would define as an investment. So David, he asks, well, he first of all says, you rock. Okay, thanks, David. If the September spike in the repo rate was the most recent signal that the end game is on, what do you see as the next signal? The next signal for me, David, would be the Fed committing to actually being involved in the repo market on a permanent basis. That's them. To me, that would be them throwing in the towel. And if you look at the repo market is tied to a lot of other important interest rates, such as the Fed funds rate. And we all just assume, me included, that although the Fed might not have that much control over the long end of the curve, that they have control over the short end. But that might not be true. I don't know if you saw my last video, I think the one on Friday, where I showed that they actually lost control of the Fed funds rate. It went outside of their target zone when we had that spike back in September. So if they go to something that they admit is permanent, meaning that they're basically taking over the repo market, that means that the United States has committed to printing more dollars than the real economy needs forever. That's really what it boils down to, if you really distill it. So that's, to me, that's huge from a standpoint of inflation, because you can say that the United States could be Japan and we could just muddle through this for 30 years and nothing's going to happen. Well, that may be true, but it might not be true. And there's so many differences between the United States and Japan on a fundamental level that I wouldn't take that bet. And then you've got to look at what's your upside and what's your downside and what the probabilities are. And I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but let's say the probabilities are 50-50 that we get inflation, but what type of catastrophic event or sequence of events does that inflation produce? And that's kind of the mental experiment that I would go through and challenge myself to think through. So I guess my short answer is the next thing I'm looking for is the Fed committing to the repo market on a permanent basis, meaning they're basically taking over the market and providing whatever liquidity it needs. And then the next step is thinking through inflation, because at some point that's got to hit, because they're having to produce on an endless basis more dollars than the real economy needs. And I could go into it further, but I think that's kind of my best short answer there. Scott W. Question: are you invested in any of the miners? No, I am not, because I've got the majority of my portfolio, Scott, in real estate. So I don't have as much as I normally have allocated to speculation. And those miners to me are a speculative play. So when I get some liquidity from my current real estate projects, meaning once I sell one, then I will take some of that and reallocate it to speculation, because I like to have about 10% there. And that's when I'm going to start looking at the miners. Okay, gold and silver miners. Okay, what's your thought on investing in miners? I appreciate your channel very much. So my main thought is that it's a speculation. Most people see it as an investment, but they're basically gambling on prices going up. And to me, I don't like doing that with a majority of my portfolio. So I think they're, now that said, I think that they're a great speculation because of where we are in the cycle, because of how much money that the Fed is printing, and because gold and to a certain extent silver is kind of the inverse of your confidence in the system and the government. And most of you on this channel, I think, and me included, don't have a heck of a lot of confidence in the system or the government. So, and I don't think it's going to get any better. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I know right now, relatively speaking, the miners are really cheap. So that's my answer. Basically, I think it's a great speculation. Alessandro, thanks for the super chat. Alessandro, if money collapses, how many ounces of gold will buy a home? This is actually a really interesting question. There's no black or white answer, Alessandro, because there's so many variables. I mean, if money collapses, I'm assuming you're talking about the dollar. Yeah, I mean, it depends how much it goes down. The one thing that I think is pretty safe to say, and there are no certainties in life or this business, but there are strong probabilities. And I think the probability is very high that regardless of what happens to the dollar, an ounce of gold will buy you the same amount of a house in 20 years as it will today. Because going back 100 years, it would have bought you the same amount of a house or close to it. So I don't know if it'll buy you more of a house, because that all depends on so many variables. But I think I can say with a certain degree of certainty that the probabilities are high that it'll at least at very minimum buy the same amount. Hopefully that answers your question. Okay, Sunshack asks, in Norway, no one seems to worry about the impending recession. If I try to bring it up, the issues you and Schiff are talking about, they just look at me weird. How can I make them see? This is a great question. And I think it's a question that we can all relate to on some level. I'm thinking how I would approach that myself. What's interesting for me is most of my family, they think the exact same way I do. So like when I went back to my sister's place for Christmas, that's where I was last week. When you guys saw me, I was at her house in Dallas. I mean, that's all we talk about. And that's my sister's in the exact same boat. And so was my mom. But if I had a buddy, this is such a good question. I really want to give it some thought. And you see, the way I am, Sunshack, is I always, I convince myself of X, Y, and Z through research, facts, and data. So I always like to bring that to the table first and foremost. But in reality, the majority of people on this planet really don't respond too well to data and facts. They respond better to emotion. So what I'm trying to think through here is how would I present this to them in a way that would elicit an emotional response or engage them on an emotional level, because that's how you're really going to make them see. You know what I might do is I would buy them a digital copy, if you can do that, of the Bubble movie. That's probably what I'd do, because since it's in movie form, it's really entertaining and you get to see kind of all the stuff that we're talking about. And if you don't know what that is, that's a movie that Tom Woods, who is a guy I'm a huge fan of, libertarian, Austrian economist, historian. He's got the Tom Woods Show, fantastic podcast. He did a movie with a guy, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but it's about the financial crisis and how that came to pass and how it was really, you look at the politicians and it goes into what Barney Frank was saying and Chris Dodd and all those knuckleheads and how they were really the catalyst. And then Wall Street just took the baton and 10x'd it, 1,000x'd it. But it shows how this really came to pass. And you could show them that. It's entertaining. They'll get it. And then you can just say, okay, well, that's where we were then. This is where we are now, meaning the amount of debt in the system. I would say, okay, then mortgages were at, let's say, $15 trillion. Now they're at $16 trillion. I'd say back then corporate debt was X. Now it's X plus Y. Consumer debt back then was X. Now consumer debt is X plus Y. So you can first and foremost engage them by showing them that movie that they're going to love, because it's a really entertaining movie. And it's got guys like Rogers and Schiff and Jim Grant and all those guys that are really fun to watch. And then once they got done with that, then I would replace it with facts from today that show how the situation has not gotten better, but it's actually gotten worse. I think that's what I do. Hey, Garrett, thanks for the super chat. Garrett, he asks, with the current economic risks and overvaluation of the housing market, is now a good time to buy? What are your three top cities to buy rental properties right now? So hopefully I've made it really clear that I do think the United States is in a housing bubble. I think that the prices are way, way, way too high. You have to come to that conclusion. You just look at the Case-Shiller or the metric for most specific markets, especially on the West Coast, and you see that the prices are higher than even adjusted for inflation than they were in 2006. So how can you say if we were in a bubble in 2006, which I think everyone would admit. How are we not in a bubble now if the prices are just as high? And how can you justify buying at a price now that is higher than it was at the top of the bubble? Just no prudent investor can justify that. That said, there are tiny little markets in the United States that no one ever pays attention to, where you can still purchase cash flow relatively cheap. And the reason I really want to emphasize cash flow is because I think one of the big mistakes that we as investors make is we look at a rental property or a real estate transaction as, am I buying this? I'm buying this because I think the price is going to go up, or I'm not buying this because I think the price is going to go down. You don't want to worry about the price. You want to worry about the cash flow. You're buying cash flow. So not that you're not worried about the home price going up or down, but you start with that level of cash flow and you say, okay, if this is good, now let's go to the next step, which is analyzing something in the market that would have to do with the actual value of the home, such as the price to income ratio. But if the cash flow doesn't make sense, you're done. Pass. I don't care what anything else is. If the cash flow doesn't make sense from the day you buy the property, then you pass. And I've seen a lot of people on YouTube, especially some of the younger kids that are really popular, they'll I don't know if they're suggesting this, but they themselves are going out and buying properties in areas like California, and then showing like a pro forma Excel spreadsheet based on the future, which who knows? And it shows that how, although they're cash flow negative right now, well, don't worry about that because we can safely assume that prices are going to appreciate at 3% in real terms, and I'm going to be able to increase rents, indefinitely for the next 30 years. And so nothing to worry about, just negative cash flow right now. Just don't mind that. That is not how you want to invest. At least that's not how I invest. And I know Jason Hartman says this all the time, and I could not agree with him more, that an investment has to make sense from the day you buy it, period. If it doesn't make sense, don't buy it and move on. So as far as the markets that I like, Kansas City, number one, that's where I think everyone knows that. If you didn't get my, or if you didn't see the video today, Garrett, that I did with my personal real estate agent in Kansas City, I'd strongly suggest watching that. She's fantastic. And we kind of really take a deep dive into that market. See, I'm trying to think, I was on, because Jason thinks about this in a very similar way as far as these linear markets. So I would go to his website. I was just on there the other day and look at where he has inventory. Indianapolis, I know, has been good for a long time. There's a couple areas in Florida that I think are pretty good. And I'm guessing the reason you can still get some good deals there is because they had some really weird laws that made it very difficult for banks to foreclose. So the foreclosure process that we had in the United States after the bust kind of had a delayed reaction. So I'm not sure if that's why the RV ratios there are still good, but that would be my guess. So Kansas City, Indianapolis, I think he had Little Rock as well. And I would like Little Rock, but I'd like a couple areas in Florida. And the reason I like Florida is just at a macro level, I think so many people are going to be moving there or moving to states that don't have state tax, such as Nevada, Texas, Florida. And so kind of, although I don't like to make my decisions on real estate based on macro, you got to start with the grounds up, starting at cash flow. I do, you know, once you get past that point, you like to consider all factors. And that's kind of why I like Florida, especially if you get those good RV ratios. So that's what I would say. But keep in mind, wherever you go, whatever market that you go into, you always want to go and buy in a neighborhood that's an A, quote unquote, A neighborhood. You got A, B, C, and sometimes some real sketchy D areas. You want to buy in an A area, even if your rate of return goes from 10% down to 7%, let's say. I would much rather have you, or me, in a type of area, because you're always going to have demand for renters, because that's where they want to live, because that's where the good schools are that they can send their kids to. And you're going to keep them there because they want to keep their kids in that school district for their, you know, from when the time they start first grade all the way through high school. As an example of that, I've got a renter in one of my properties in Kansas City that I've had them since 2012. When I actually bought, that was when I first got into real estate. This was one of the very first properties that I bought. And Christine actually helped me buy this one. And it was a foreclosure. I think I bought from the bank. I bought it for 50 grand. I put 25,000 into it. So my cost basis was 75,000. Now the rents are, I think I rented it out back then for $1,000 a month. And now the rents are up to like 1,400. It's tripled in price, or the base. Well, not really. No, it's doubled. Well, I won't go into that. It's probably, 75. It's probably worth 175 now. So from what my cost basis was, it's gone up by 100 grand. But again, that's not why you're buying it. You're buying it for the cash flow. And you can do the math on, you know, 1,400 a month for a $75,000 cost basis. Not that you could get that deal now, but I'm off on a tangent. My point is, I've had those renters there because it's a solid, solid school district. And their kids at the time when they moved in were like second, third grade. And the reason they've stayed there is because they've wanted their kids to stay in that school system. So wherever you go, make sure that you're very cognizant of the area and the neighborhood and the school district and all that stuff. Okay. Hopefully I'm pronouncing this right. It's Petrovic. I appreciate the super chat, my friend. And his question is, if the bubble deflates, where will the money flow? If the money flows into real estate or real assets, will that break the wall and cause inflation, or will it stay in the financial system? So you've got to remember that most of the bubbles are paper wealth. Let's look at the stock market as an example. If the stock market goes down by 50%, that cash is just gone, or that wealth. There's no money to roll into anything else. It's just poof, gone. It's not like there's a rotation from stocks into bonds, and that's what's creating, although that could have something to do with it, but the bond market is at all-time highs as well. So, and since everything is just paper wealth, I don't really think that there's a big rotation of liquidity because of the everything bubble. Now that said, there is going to be some rotation. So if I had to put my money on where it's going to rotate, I think gold, I think most likely real estate. And the reason I say real estate is because if you look at how this is played out in other countries, especially in South America, like Venezuela as an example, when most people would be very surprised to know that when Venezuela first started their problems that they had, when the first, I would say, 3 years, I actually looked into Venezuelan real estate, and the prices actually went up, not just in nominal terms, but in real terms, adjusted for inflation. And you may ask yourself, well, how could that be? Because people saw what was going on, all the Venezuelan people. And they took as much cash as they had, any liquid assets, and sold them, you know, stocks, bonds, cash, anything. And they dumped it right into real estate. So that drove prices up, even adjusted for inflation. So we could get something like that in the United States. I think you'd see capital flows into foreign countries' stock market, especially emerging markets. I think you'd see that. But then if we're on a digital currency, then the U.S. is going to set up capital controls. Oh, I'm sorry, but you're talking about Europe. Okay. Well, Europe could do the exact same thing. They have like a digital euro. But I'm not sure where you would go in Europe to get ahead of that curve, because I think that's really what your question is about. Other than having gold and maybe some rental properties in some of the Eastern countries that are a little more stable as far as their debt to GDP ratios, like Lithuania, Estonia. Last time I checked, Croatia was pretty good. I love spending time there myself. Greece actually had a conference call or consulting call with a gentleman the other day. It's a great, great call. And we talked about potentially moving some money into Greece because you're always going to have that component of tourism. So that's kind of how I'd look at it if I was in the United, or if I was in Europe right now. Okay, Phil asks, is this a bad time to pay down personal debt? It depends, Phil, if that debt is has an adjustable interest rate or if that debt is consumption-based. So if you're talking about a credit card, pay it off. Pay it off as fast as you can because that's not doing anything for you. It's and your interest rate's sky high and it could even go higher because it's adjustable. And that purchasing power that you leverage the credit card for, most likely it was based on consumption. So it's not making you any money. Debt can be great and it can be really, really bad. It all depends on what you use it for, excuse me. So if you're using it for consumption, that's bad. Pay that off as quickly as you can. If it's being used to make you even more money, then that's good. So if you've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage on a rental property that's cash flow positive, no, do not pay that off because you're getting paid to short the dollar. So most of us are kind of under the mindset that long-term in the United States, 10 years, 20 years down the road, we will see substantial inflation. And if you're in that camp, then you definitely want to have fixed rate mortgage that's paying you to own it. So it all depends on what type of debt that you're talking about. Okay, Big Love asks, investments need to pay you to own them. Yes, I'd like to suggest looking into cryptocurrency masternodes. Masternodes pay you to own it. Okay. I'd recommend looking at Divi and Dash for masternode ownership. Okay. If I've got some time, I'll do that. I'd be a little curious how they're paying you if the underlying asset does not produce cash flow. I'm not sure how that would work or how safe that cash flow stream is, but I don't know anything about it, so I'll leave it at that. Wally, thanks for being on the chat again, Wally. Appreciate it. Asks, do you have any idea how they have been able to keep the derivatives market going on for so long? It's into the trillions, possibly quadrillions. So my answer is because they've artificially suppressed interest rates. And if you think about what they're doing in the repo market right now, I think like Luke Groman says, if the Fed wasn't in the repo market right now, the rates would probably be close to 10%. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So if the Fed funds rate was up near that level, I mean, the derivatives market is poof, gone. It's toast, especially because, and I don't want to get too into the weeds, but the majority of the derivatives market is interest rate swaps. So I don't want to confuse people too much. And I'm going to be going into this extensively on my video tomorrow, where I've got the benefit of the whiteboard, make it a lot easier. But basically, an interest rate swap is when someone has an adjustable rate loan and they want a fixed rate loan. Someone steps in, a counterparty like Deutsche Bank, and says, okay, we'll pay your adjustable rate as long as you give us a fixed rate. So let's say the adjustable rate right now is 5% that this corporation is getting. But they're like, I don't want to take this interest rate risk if it spikes to 10%. Deutsche Bank will come in and say, okay, you're at 5% right now. We'll go ahead and assume that risk. And as long as you just pay us 7% on however much your loan balance is. And then if interest rates go down, Deutsche pockets the spread between 7 and 5. Problem is that, of course, if interest rates go above 7%, now Deutsche is eating the spread. And if you think about that quadrillion dollars being in these interest rate, or the majority of them being in these interest rate swaps, which I believe they are, we get high interest rates, or the Fed loses control of the short end, and whoa, my goodness, it all comes crashing down. So that goes back to the earlier question, what do I see the next shoe to drop, or what am I looking for? It's again, going back to the Fed being in the repo market permanently, because then they're acknowledging that they understand the derivatives risk and how systemic it is, and they have no way out. So regardless of how bad inflation gets, they will not be able to stop printing money. So hopefully that answers your question. Okay, Phil, thanks for the super chat. Says, lower your property taxes, Google tax bender. Okay, I'll try that out, Phil. Carl, thanks for the super chat. Asks, can I access 100K in my superannuation, which is similar to your 401K? We're here in Australia. Can use it to invest in property. Should I wait for upcoming housing crash to do it? Boy, Carl, I'm not sure how those work. Assuming that it's like a 401K, you can, I think that you can turn that into a self-directed 401K. And if you're asking me if you should invest in property in Australia, my answer would be no, because unless you can get an RV ratio that's above 1%, but prices are so high in Australia, like Canada and New Zealand. I mean, you would know better than I would, but I don't think you can even come close to getting a 1% RV ratio there. Now, if you're asking me about investing in property in the US, well, that might be different, or in another country that's closer to you where you could get some solid cash flow, then that's something that I'd look into. Okay, a business, looks like Neurosurgery Highland. Thank you for the super chat. Asks, would you take a loan on your house, on your home equity, to invest in commodity futures to hedge your equity and have cash to invest in real estate if the bubble pops? I don't really like that, because it's tough, because you're really not matching up your assets with your liabilities. And so the liability, and I don't know if this home equity is where you actually live, or if it's a rental property. If it's where you live and you lose your job, then that could affect the home equity if it goes down. If you have to force sell, there's a lot of variables right here. But let me try to get to the main point, assuming everything kind of stays the same. And I'm not sure how investing in commodities futures would hedge your equity, because you're assuming that if your equity goes down, then commodity prices will go up. And I don't know that that's a correct assumption. So I think my short answer would be no, I would not do that, because you're relying on a lot of different variables. And if you're going to take your home equity out to invest in something, I would suggest doing that in something that more matches your home equity, like a revenue or a cash flow stream from an additional piece of real estate, or at least something that's paying you to own it and that's not speculative. So that would be my answer there. Okay, R. Yamada, thank you for the super chat. Asks, in a financial crisis, does setting gold price to 100,000 really restore confidence in the system, or does this just affirm that fiat currencies are worthless and lead to hyperinflation in other goods? I think it depends on whether or not that new currency is backed by gold, or if you're just asking if gold price just goes to the moon. If the gold price goes to the moon, I don't think that really restores confidence at all. But if they come out and say, okay, we're now backing the dollar with gold, we're going back to a gold standard, then I would say yes, that would restore confidence. And the reason I would say yes is if you look at other countries that have had hyperinflation and they fixed it, they basically fixed it by restoring confidence by introducing a fiat currency that people trusted. And if there's no fiat currencies that people trust, you back it with a commodity like gold, and boom, I think all of a sudden people are okay with it. And I think that would quickly restore confidence. And I think, you know, Rickards was really gung-ho on the SDRs. And I think he's, as far as if we get a currency collapse, I think he's kind of backed off that a little. And now he's more leaning toward the world going back to a gold standard. And if you look at the central banks, they're all hoarding gold. I think that's the long game that they see as well, or the most likely, that's kind of their base case. Let me put it that way. I'm not saying that we're going to have a gold standard tomorrow or it's 100%. I'm just saying that if you look at the actions of the central banks, I think that is their long-term base case, is that we will go back to a gold standard. Okay, Cody asks, are you at all concerned that extreme government control will be placed in the markets due to wealth inequality, derivatives going out of control, and populism movements? I don't know that you're going to get government control, and I'm assuming when you're talking about extreme government control, you're talking about the Fed controlling markets due to inequality. I don't know if they do that, but I think they do it just because they know that the financial markets are now the economy. We financialized our entire economy in the United States and in most of the developed countries. So they know they have to prop it up at any cost. Now, that said, they can prop it up in nominal terms and it can still lose value in real terms. So don't think that just because the Fed steps in to prop everything up that it's all peaches and sunshine. I think on Twitter the other day, I retweeted a chart of the Venezuelan stock market and how much it went up, and then what it went up in terms of, or went down in terms of gold or the dollar or something to that effect. But it really shows you how the nominal S&P is almost meaningless. Then you go on, derivatives getting out of control. So, but let me go back to the wealth inequality part, because that's really important. I think that moving forward, 2020-21, that we're going to see more of a QE for the people, or helicopter money, especially with the pension crisis. I think that the politicians are going to look at the Fed's balance sheet of $4 trillion and say, look at this. They printed all this money. They bailed out Wall Street. There was no inflation. Therefore, why can't we increase the balance sheet by another $4 trillion and bail out Main Street? I think that's going to be their rationale, and I think it's going to be a really easy sell. And I think the Republicans are going to be saying that, and the Democrats. And that's when you get that money flowing, or that liquidity from the financial system. It'll still be in the financial system. They'll just print more of it to inject it via helicopter money into the real economy. That's when I think you're going to see that inflation kick in, because that velocity will really start to ratchet up. Most people don't realize that if you look at M2, a chart, it's just a hockey stick up, but the velocity of money is at an all-time low as well. So if we just get a couple notch up in velocity, and we can't really decrease the money supply. I mean, the repo market's a good example of that. You're just going to see some severe, severe inflation. And populism movements, I think that plays into it. Okay, so it looks like we've got a business here that is, thank you for the super chat. The business name is Nothingness Abounds Productions. So it sounds like a really cool production company. The question is, do you see real estate crashes coming in Canada, New Zealand, Australia? Yes. I think that at some point in time, you can't keep it propped up on just hopes and dreams and negative worldwide interest rates forever. Because that's really what's going on, especially in Canada. And I was in Vancouver at the beginning of this year, and I could not believe the prices out there. But more so, I don't want to really get fixated on that. I want to ask a different question. I don't want to ask, do I see a real estate crash coming? I want to first and foremost ask the question, is the market, meaning the real estate market in Canada, New Zealand, and Australia, is it cheap or is it expensive? Because that answers all, or that solves the decision making, and that gets it. That goes right to the crux of the issue. So, and it's much easier to see it clearly that way. If your answer is yes, the market is expensive, then don't buy anything there. if you can somehow, or, and I don't think you could, but if you somehow come to the conclusion that the Canadian real estate market is cheap based on cash flow, again, I don't know how you come to that conclusion, but then that means you consider buying. But it's not about, do I think it's going to crash, or do I think the prices are going up or going down? Just I know the end game is answering that question, but I think if we retrain ourselves to think about it in a different way, it makes the decision-making process far easier. So again, just to reiterate, start with the question, is the housing market in Canada cheap or is it expensive? Matt, thanks for the super chat. Matt, is this week Y2K or the January 14th Y2K? I haven't done much research on January 14th, but I did a video on what I call the Y2K. It's kind of the Zoltan Pozar prediction for the repo market. And it looks like the liquidity needs of the repo market have been met. Because if you look at the statements that the New York Fed is giving us on their overnight repos, they are undersubscribed. So there's less demand for that liquidity than the Fed was expecting. That said, Zoltan was very specific that this would occur at the very, you know, not just like a week before the year end, but right at the turn. So that means that we need to really watch it tomorrow and Tuesday. That's, if we're going to see fireworks, that's when we are going to see them. So on that note, tomorrow I'm doing the Deutsche Bank video. And on Tuesday, I'm going to do a video on the repo market again and seeing, and hopefully the New York Fed has updated their website so we can see what's happening, where the rates are, and how those additional term repos that they added, I think they added that once they saw Zoltan's report, but we can see how those panned out. So that's what I'm going to be going over on that video Tuesday, most likely, if the reports have come out. If they haven't come out, then I'll probably save it for like a Thursday video. But make sure that you're watching that. And to stay posted in real time, I would just check out the New York Fed's website. If you Google New York Fed repo operations, it should come right up. Jerry asks, thanks for the super chat, Jerry. Okay, Jerry received $100K. I owe $65. Should I pay it off before it hits the fan? HELOC, second mortgage, and get a rental? Jerry, I'm going to assume that you've got a fixed rate mortgage. And if you have a fixed rate mortgage, I would not pay that off. I would leave it be, and I would take the $100. And I would follow my strategy there, which is 10% gold, 10% speculative. The other, I'd say 50%, I'd invest into something that pays you to own it. And then I'd have some liquidity and keep powder dry in case it does hit the fan and you can buy assets cheap. And the way I suggest doing that, guys, with your cash, if you're keeping cash on the sidelines, don't keep it in the bank. I get a lot of people saying, yeah, I'm just keeping my powder dry and I've got it all in my money market account. Or, oh my gosh, no. Don't, or got it a CD or something. Oh my gosh, don't do that. Because look, how are you getting that additional interest rate? Because they're taking your money and they're putting it to work in the repo market, potentially. So I always ask people, do you want your $100,000 in savings being lent to Deutsche Bank overnight or for a 34-day term repo? I mean, most people's answer would be hell no. And if that's your answer, then you don't want it in a money market account or a CD. So then you say a bank account. Well, now you're not getting any interest at all. And you got the counterparty risk of the bank. And who knows who the Fed is propping up and how much systemic risk there is there for your bank, if you're with Wells Fargo or a B of A or something like that. So I think the safest place, and I know it sounds crazy for me to say this, but I think it's just in T-bills. I think you just take the liquidity, put it in the T-bills, maybe 3 months, 6 months, and just roll it over. You're going to get a higher interest rate. And then your counterparty is the U.S. government. And I mean, I at the end of the day, they can print the money to pay you back. So I know on one hand, I say how bad that is, and I truly believe that. But I don't. I think it's prudent to, if the system is the way it is, I think it's prudent to take advantage of it. And I don't see a better place other than your mattress to store a substantial amount of cash to keep your powder dry than in 3 month T-bills or 6 month. Okay, I'm going to make sure that I'm answering your entire question here, Jerry, before I move on. So I think we got the mortgage. Okay, should I pay it off? Okay, HELOC. Or a second mortgage to get a rental. Yeah, I just keep doing what you're doing, but just take that 100 and break it down the way I suggested. And again, I don't know your personal situation, so I can't give you specific investment advice. When I'm saying this, Jerry, I'm basically telling you what I would do if it was my $100,000. Okay, ROI company, thank you for the super chat. Asks, real estate projects with kinship possible pitfalls. Well, doing anything with kinship. I'm not in kinship. I'm assuming you're talking about family. Boy, that's a tough one. Let me put it to you this way, because I've got a couple projects that I'm doing with family, but I just know them so well, and we really see eye to eye on everything. But I think the fewer partnerships you can have, the better. The more control you can have over your own investments in your own portfolio, I think the better it is. So that would apply to partnering with a friend, with a family member, or that would also apply to putting your money in a REIT or some sort of investment vehicle that someone else manages. I'm not saying that all of them are bad. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying if I had a choice, I would much prefer to be in control of 100% of my portfolio. And that would, with very few exceptions. I mean, if you've got a family member like I have that where you really, really see eye to eye with that person, and it's more of a relationship where, well, I don't think I'll go down that path. I'm just going to leave it there. If you've got a relationship with that family member where you just really see eye to eye on everything, including business decisions, how aggressive you are with risk or not aggressive, then I would consider it. But at the end of the day, it's better just to have one hand in that cookie jar. Or one cook in that kitchen would probably be a better way to say it. Okay, next super chat from another business. And the business is Neurosurgery Highland. Oh, I think that's the second super chat. So Neurosurgery Highland, thank you again. You mentioned a good friend of yours is good at selling cars on Craigslist. Good is an understatement. He is not just a professional. He is like a ninja at selling cars on Craigslist. Can he mentor me on the process? Can you connect me with him or her? probably not. He's just so busy doing that. But that said, if you connect with Sebastian, I did that just kind of as a hobby. A few years ago, I helped my younger brother out, and he lives in Tucson. Well, I moved him to Tucson because he is having some allergy issues. And I stayed in Tucson for about a year just to help him out. And I got really bored. So I won't go into a long story here. But the bottom line is I started flipping trucks just for fun. And I actually got really good at it. I made a lot of money doing it. So that was, I'd buy them on Craigslist and I'd flip them on eBay. So I'm more than happy to go through that process with you. So if you want to book an hour, that would probably be a really good use of your time. Just email Sebastian at admin@georgegammon.com and we can set up a Skype call where I can walk you through that one-on-one. But I saw someone responding to Neurosurgery Highland saying that, I think what I saw there was that you can also get some good deals on Facebook and then flip them on eBay. And that is definitely true. I know my buddy Brandon does get some really good deals on Facebook. Okay, Andrew asks, if a radical new form of energy tech was proven to be true, would this immediately affect markets? I would assume so. Well, but wait, let me think that through. I don't know that it would immediately affect markets, because to deliver that energy, you have to have an infrastructure set up for that. So that's one of the reasons why we can't just flip right over to electricity or like nat gas or something, because there's just not the infrastructure or hydrogen. And so it depends on what that form of energy looked like and how it would be delivered. So I think my answer would be long term, obviously it would really, really affect markets, but short term, I don't know that it would. Okay, Greek Geek Consulting asks, I cash out of stocks thinking buying dividend stocks and REITs for income. Do you think this is smart to maintain cash flow? Should I buy T-bills instead? 150K in IRA accounts. My problem with that is the underlying asset that you're buying just is so expensive and it's such a bubble. I mean, if it's a REIT, I don't like commercial REITs unless it's maybe like elderly, like adult foster homes. That might be interesting. Most of the REITs, I don't think they have residential. You know, multifamily might, but the multifamilies, the cap rates are so low on that. That's really, I don't want to say it's in a bubble, but man, it's overpriced. Unless you could find some dividend yielding stocks outside of the United States or REITs outside of the United States where it's a lot cheaper. Other than that, for cash flow, I just go back to Old Faithful, which is the normal linear market real estate that I always talk about for cash for a rental property. Okay, William, thank you for the super chat. William, how did we deal with the 2008 economic crash? And can I do the same thing to save myself? If not, how? Okay, let me piece through this question here. How did we deal with the 2008 economic crash? Well, we papered over it by printing money. The whole world just the central banks bailed out the economy by printing money, and now the governments are pitching in with what they're trying to do with fiscal stimulus, is basically just racking up more debt. So with debt and money printing is how they dealt with that. Can I do the same thing to save myself? Well, unfortunately, you probably don't want to rack up too much debt unless it's productive debt, like I've been talking about. And obviously, you can't print your own money. But what you can do is you can align yourself with the interests of the government, which we don't have to like the government to profit from their profligate spending. What I mean by that is by getting a fixed rate mortgage, then they're going to have to eat away all of that debt that they use to fix the crisis through inflation or default, which pretty much is the same thing. And so if you put yourself on that side where you benefit and you profit from the government inflating away their debts, that's a good way to quote unquote save yourself. But I think it just comes down to basic strategy, in the sense that you want to, if you've got some good hard assets that are paying you, if you've got 10% in gold, I think that that's the best way to protect yourself, really. And you're just making smart decisions and you research it and you're going, whether it's real estate or even a gold investment where you're thinking about where you want to store it, just do the homework. And I think if you do that and then you look at your portfolio and you kind of use game theory, in the sense that you say, okay, I've got this asset, this asset, this asset. What if we go through the 1970s type of inflation? How is my portfolio most likely going to perform? If we go through a 1930s type of deflation, how is my portfolio? Basically, you're stress testing your portfolio. And when you do that, I think that you'll sleep a lot easier at night if you have your portfolio set up in the way that I think you should. Okay, Bala asks, are credit unions any better than banks for saving your money? I would say, and there's pros and cons there, I would say on net balance, yes. But I still would rather be in short-term T-bills. Like that's how I'm going to go with that answer. What was that game show? That's my final answer. Okay, so William has, I just saw your question there. So Sebastian, I'm reading the second part of William's question. He says he forgot to mention that I'm in Switzerland. I'm 19, so I might as well invest in gold, should I? Well, you got your whole life in front of you, William, and from the way you're thinking right now, the chances are you're going to be financially very successful if you're thinking like this at that age. I think at 19, the only thing I was thinking about is, well, we won't go into what I was thinking about at 19. I don't want to incriminate myself. So invest in gold. I tell you what, William, since you're so young, I would have a little gold, but I might even lean a little bit more towards the miners because it's a little more of a speculation. And at your age, you can afford to speculate a little bit. So I like gold because I like that to always have some sort of insurance right in your back pocket. But I think for you, I might suggest a bigger percentage in the form of speculation. And I think the miners are a good way to do that. But again, you got to do your homework, buddy. Make sure you do your homework because not all gold miners are created equal. There's some good ones and there's some really, 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 really bad ones. Okay, and Greek Geek Consulting, to follow up there, I need further clarification. Cannot buy physical real estate in IRA accounts. Okay, I thought you couldn't have self-directed, but I don't know much about those. To preserve capital, stay cash, go to T-bills. T-bills. Yeah. If you want to keep some dry powder there, that's what I suggest, going into T-bills. Whichever, 3 months, 6 months, whatever you choose. It's kind of a pain in the butt because you got to manually roll them over, but I think it's well worth it. Oh, hey, my buddy Suicide Van. Thanks for being on the live stream. My buddy says, hey, George, aren't big banks actually safer because they, meaning the government, won't let them fail. They're too big to fail, so they'll always be bailed out where a credit union might be allowed to fail. That's a fantastic point. I know Schiff always says that I think Schiff one time said he has got all of his money in B of A, because not all of his money, but a cash account, because he feels as though they'll definitely get bailed out. It's a pro and con because like I'm with a really small bank in Kansas City and they've just been fantastic to work with. And I'm really good buddies with the VP of their commercial lending department. And when I was first kind of trying to decide what bank I wanted to use in KC, we've gone to dinner tons of times, but this time he walked me through what their loan book did in the crash. And they keep all of their loans in-house. They don't sell anything to Fannie and Freddie. They keep all their paper. And he showed me their loan, didn't show me the exact loan book, but kind of the Reader's Digest version. And they only had a 3% default rate in the great financial crisis. That is a prudent bank. That is old school banking right there. So my point with the credit union is hopefully they're as prudent as my buddy is with this small bank in Kansas City. So I guess if you don't have the opportunity to know the VP of commercial lending on a personal basis, then yeah, it might be smart to go with Wells Fargo or B of A, something like that. But if you can build a relationship with someone at the bank so you can get to know and understand their lending process, and just how smart the people are that are saying yes or no to the loan, then I think that could be a better way to go. So it all depends on that. But that's a great point, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Okay, Nick asks, should I sell my 2014 F-250 and buy 30K in gold silver bars? We have zero debt and already have a lot in the stock market. It depends on how much of your portfolio that $30,000 would be as far as going into gold. Now, I mean, even if you don't want to go into gold, I'd sell a 2014 F-250 because that's just going to depreciate. And trucks nowadays, I've owned a lot of Italian cars, and the trucks nowadays, as far as their maintenance, it's like owning a Ferrari. I mean, good. It's just craziness. You can't take it to the shop and spend less than $1,000. So I'd sell that thing regardless. And if you want to buy if you're a truck guy, Nick, my goodness, get a 2002 F-250 Power Stroke 7.3. I'd parlay it into that. I mean, you can't go wrong there. Or if you like the OBS body style, which I think is really popular, I love, if you get an old, like a 97 F-250, like an extended cab, or the crew cabs are, in my opinion, look awesome. I love the crew cabs. I would do that, and then consider the gold. Or if you have another car, I guess you probably have another vehicle, so you don't really need to parlay it into another truck. But again, to answer your question, if you have $300,000 in assets, then yeah, I think that would make sense. But I don't really suggest going over 10% in gold or silver. Okay, William, thanks for another super chat, buddy. I appreciate it. I'm also slightly scared that the U.S. starts going to war with a buttload more people for their resources. Yeah. I think that's, I mean, if you look at history, William, I don't think you're too far off base. That's, well, I don't want to single out the U.S. because pretty much every country that's got into the position of the U.S., it just throws their weight around and uses it to bully every other country and start limitless wars, which as you guys know, I'm not a real big fan of. But I don't know how, especially if you're in Switzerland, I don't know that would really play into my investment strategy other than making sure that I own a little bit of gold as an insurance policy, because if that really played out and it got really, really bad, then you want something there that's going to be the inverse of worldwide stability. Okay, Sebastian says we're at an hour and a half, so we'll kind of start to wrap things up here. A few more questions. Ian, thanks for the super chat. Ian, do you have a view on Bitcoin as digital gold to hedge? My view on Bitcoin is it's a great speculation, but it is not digital gold. That is not to say that in the future it can't be, but right now it isn't, simply because of the volatility and because it doesn't have the 5,000-year history that gold does. But I don't put them into the same category. A lot of people do. And to me, they're just apples and oranges. So one is insurance and one is a speculation. So that's how I see it. And I don't know that Bitcoin would be a hedge. I was going to say, I don't think it's really a hedge, but it may be, I guess, if you've got a dollar collapse, then it could be a hedge for sure. But it's a risky hedge. Let me just put it to you that way. Okay, Banker Music. And thanks for showing up in the chat all the time, Banker Music. I always see you there, and I really appreciate it. There's a lot of people that I see consistently in the chats, and I always try to make sure that I respond or reply to their comments first and foremost. I know you're one of them, so I appreciate the support. Okay, so his question is single father, okay? Net worth 20 grand, all righty. Physically migrate to South America after dollar collapse, a good idea. I'm a hustler, and socialism will swash folks like me. Okay. This is another question that I have to answer as though it's me. So, because everyone's family situation is different. I don't know how you make your money. I don't know if you're saying that you can physically migrate, like if you're doing something online to give you that type of mobility. But what I can tell you is that if I had a child and I was able to make my living online, especially if I was generating dollars, it's a no-brainer. Complete no-brainer. Moving to South America or an area like South America. You know, there's some place, a few places in Europe that I would put in that category because of the cost of living and the standard and the quality of life. But you've got to look at the fact that, like where I'm in Colombia, if you're bringing in $3,000 a month, US, in Colombia, that would have the same purchasing power as 15 grand a month in the United States, if not more. In fact, I would go so far as to say your quality of life would probably be better here with 3 grand a month than it would in the US at 15, not just your purchasing power. So for me, it's just, why would you not do that? And you're getting out of a country that's trying to pick fights with every single country on the planet Earth. And do you really want to be in that? You know, I don't want to say anything. It's tough. As you guys can see, I really struggle with this because I don't want to say anything like really negative, because the US, I mean, that's where I was born and raised. That's my country. And I hope that they do well. But I don't like the fact they always go around and just kick wasps' nests or hornets' nests. That's going to get you in a lot of trouble in the long term. And I just don't like being a part of that. I don't even like watching it, but I just like being removed, and also being removed from the whole US news cycle of just, it's nothing but craziness. And it just doesn't help you think more clear. It helps you think, it makes you think less clearly. So then finally, if I had a kid, I would not want my kid in the US school system. And I don't talk about this very much because I, you know, who am I to talk? I don't have a kid, but the way the school system, or the direction of the curriculum in the US school system, I would want zero part of that for my kid. I mean, I won't go into great detail, but when it comes to the safe spaces and the way they teach economics and the way they teach US history, I just don't want my kid to be a part of that. So hopefully that answers your question. Let's take a couple more here. So Guy One, Super Chat. No question, just supporting the channel. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Vineet asks, I am from India. Should I also hedge against my domestic currency, which is the rupee? How dollar collapse could affect you in the future? How should I allocate towards hard assets in my portfolio? The strategy that I suggest for Americans, it's universal. So when I say that you want to buy things when they're cheap, pay to own them, diversify your currency risk and political risk, that would apply to a citizen, whether they're in the US, Canada, China, Colombia, for that matter, or India. It's just a matter of how you want to divvy up your portfolio. Because Vineet, if your bills and your expenses are in rupees, you want to adjust your portfolio so the majority of your cash flow is matching up with your expenses. So, because you don't want to take on that currency risk, meaning that you wouldn't want to have 90% of your portfolio in, let's say, the US or Colombia, if 100% of your bills are in rupees, because then if the rupee goes down, then if the rupee goes up in value, then you could be losing some purchasing power because all your cash flow is coming in that currency that's being devalued. So as an example, if I'm talking to someone in the United States that where all their bills are obviously in dollars, even if they're really gung-ho on investing outside of the United States, I still only tell them, you know, maybe 60-70% in the US and maybe 30-40% outside. So keep that in mind. Now, as far as the dollar collapse affecting you, I would have to see how much a US dollar denominated debt India has. And I haven't done that. So that would be my starting point. So if India has a lot of dollar denominated debt, on one side of the coin, that would actually be beneficial because it would be lowering the cost of their debt in terms of rupees, which is where their revenue is coming in. Their meaning the Indian government. Now, could it have other economic effects, such as when the U.S. catches a cold, the whole world gets sick type of thing? Yes, it definitely could, because nowadays, especially with the banking system and the financial system, everything is so intertwined that it would be tough for there to have a big collapse in the U.S. and have other countries completely isolated from that, other than like small countries like Montenegro, as an example. But that's where I'd start to answer your question, Vineet, is I would look at, you know, what do you have the majority of your expenses in as far as which currency? That's how I'd set up my portfolio. And then look to see how much dollar-denominated debt India has. Hey, Christian, thank you for the super chat. Asks, would you buy two properties with one cash and second with mortgage, or would you suggest both mortgage and keep cash properties in Croatia? I don't really think it matters too much. Well, let me think here. If you've got one all in cash, then you might be able to pull out a little more equity or have a bigger line of credit if you did one in all cash. I'd have to look at the actual numbers and, you know, 'cause what's your LTV? But I don't think it would make that much of a difference if it was just a straight cash flow play up with real estate. And so I'm assuming, Christian, you're in either Split or Dubrovnik or Zagreb. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, the capital. I've been to all those places. I love them. And I know that especially if you're on one of those areas on the coast, if you've got boots on the ground there and you can be patient, get a good deal. At least when I was looking at properties and I was putting, I don't own anything in Croatia, but I've put quite a few offers in. This was a couple years ago. Boy, the cash flow would be great with their Airbnb down there, especially if you live right there and you manage it yourself. So I don't know how it is now, but that's definitely something that I would consider. Yeah. So, and then Banker Music, thanks for the second super chat. It looks like your child is starting kindergarten in the summer. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what they're teaching in kindergarten or first grade, second grade, but if it's anything like the direction that they're going once they get to high school and college, I just wouldn't want my kid to be a part of that. So that, again, I would strongly consider South America. Okay. We got the super chats flowing in here. So I've gone a little late, but that's okay. GDC, thanks for the super chat, asks, hey, George, can you do a video in the future explaining cost push versus demand pull inflation in relationship to MMT? Thanks for a great weekly chat. I think that would be a good video. I can't promise that I'll do it, but I think that's a fantastic idea. Okay, I think that's going to be it, guys. I sure appreciate everyone being on. It looks like we had well over 600 people, which I think is an all-time high. So appreciate everyone's support. I want to wish everyone a really safe holiday for New Year's, and we're going to have a great 2020 on this channel. I've got some awesome, awesome things in store that I'm super excited about. We're really going to up the level of the content. That's our goal. And just to reiterate, if you guys want to book an hour of my time specifically so I can take a deep dive into your personal situation, then make sure that you email Sebastian at admin@georgegammon.com. And then just stay tuned for tomorrow's video, guys, on Deutsche Bank, because they're going to love it. And I will see you then.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.